Hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court, sit of Hawaii, draw nigh. Do you have any?
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-15-643, State v. Lavoie. Arguing for the petitioner, Matthew Cohn. Arguing for the respondent, Emlyn Higa. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Cohn and Mr. Higa. Are you both ready to proceed? All right. Mr. Cohn, we've reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning light with 8 minutes to go. Mr. Higa, we will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court, Matthew Cohn on behalf of defendant appellant Marlene Lavoie, and we're here to present to this case a case which is brought up on cert petition raising several issues of error. There are several broad issues. Is there any issue that the court would prefer that I start with?
Well, if you want to address the prior bad acts, that would certainly be helpful, I think.
Yes. That was the primary issue that was focused on the cert petition. And our issue is that that act should not have been brought in the way that it was. The argument from the prosecutor was that the door had been opened and that they could bring in prior bad acts, 404B evidence, on that basis. And our position is that there still had to be an analysis that was done by the trial judge. And while we acknowledge the judge did some analysis, the record appears that it was just primarily on the basis that the door is open that evidence would come in. The ICA...
Mr. Cohn, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but while you're on that, can you explain your understanding of the reason that witness Aya was being questioned about this idea that the defendant had not stayed at the house and had decided to leave when the incident occurred? I think that's what, loosely speaking, was described as the reason that on cross-examination the decision was made to question IA about leaving.
You know, Your Honor, I'm not sure, and I spoke with other defense counsel to try and get an idea, and I would have to agree in retrospect, as I was not trial counsel, that it was perhaps not the shrewdest move to go into asking questions about that. But my thought is maybe it was to have some evidence towards whether the reasonableness equation on the EMED defense.
Did it go to the testimony that the defense was anticipating the experts were going to give about the fact that that was a factor that would explain EMED defense and also lack of penal responsibility?
I'm not sure, and because generally cross-examination is to test credibility and memory of the witness, and it is possible that defense counsel thought that she might say something which she could then impugn her credibility, which was one of our points in the opening brief, is to say that while there are one or two cases that talk about opening the door on a case in chief during cross-examination, generally opening the door is something that comes more federal court case law. Opening the door comes up when a party is taking direct evidence. They open the door so that the opposing party in cross-examination can clear something up that is unclear. But we would say that the trial court still was required to do an analysis, 403. It needed to determine, does this bad acts evidence, what's the strength of the other evidence? How much time lapse has there been? What's the need for the evidence?
Wasn't the judge's theory that, if he's been inflicting abuse upon her, then the question was, would it be reasonable for him to get upset? So the question was, did these priors show that after he committed abuse in these other incidents, that there was a separation? Is there anything like that?
There was a bit of testimony of different things, but it wasn't focused on. And the ICA seemed to be concerned with they needed it for the issue of intent. But as we've pointed out, intent they said they need it for intent and to rebut the EMED defense. But intent is not an issue of that kind of defense. And Hawaii case law says that it's never the government's burden to have to put on evidence to defeat an affirmative defense. It's not their burden. And the mens rea, the issue of intent, wasn't an element of an EMD defense or a 704 defense.
Didn't the trial court, it seemed like the circuit court, believe the evidence was relevant because there was a pattern, apparently, of incidents occurring after, I think it's Malia, correct?
Yes.
Kahalevi would leave him, the defendant, and then there would be, after a period of days, confrontations, anger, sometimes incidents involving physical abuse that would occur, and that pattern undercut or might undercut in the jury's mind the suggestion that on this particular day when the shooting occurred that the defendant would have been overcome with emotion by the fact that she had left him for a couple of days. So in essence, that this was something that was sort of normal or had happened before, maybe not normal, but it happened before in their relationship, and that would tend to be at tension with the theory that his part of the reason he reacted the way he did was he was so distraught at her having left him. What's your analysis of that? That sort of theory that appeared to be among the reasons given by the circuit court.
It would be relevant, but presenting the prior domestic abuse incidents, we would argue, was not properly weighed by the court.
But actually, in terms of the five prior incidents, other than the the decedent leaving and then the death resulting after that. The five prior incidents, was there any evidence whatsoever that she had actually left? That there had been, that she left after these
that is
apparent
point.
Domestic violence
That's
incidents?
That's a good point, Your Honor. That was not clear in the record. And that
it's not clear. Is there any evidence that she left after the prior five incidents that he allegedly physically abused her?
No, there was not. There was an incident where she went to Honolulu and left, but it didn't tie into any of the specific bad acts evidence that they introduced. And these were instances, he was never charged with any of this stuff. There was no determination, was this actually true? And it's coming from third parties who may have observed or said that they did, but there's a question. And we say that case law says there needs to be some inquiry as to, well, is this even, and it'd be one thing if there was an arrest report or a charge, but the prosecutor in his case in chief is bringing up these bad acts evidence without any verification. What was the need for the evidence? They had a shooting in front of witnesses. They recovered the gun. They had statements of the defendant.
Well, Mr. Colm, what the judge said was being under extreme emotional disturbance because someone has left and not willing to come back is one circumstance. But the causing the person to leave by acts of physical abuse and then saying their emotional distress because of that. And the judge also, and even Mr. Dunn said, we think that this might open the door. So insofar as your argument that they didn't need to do it, I think the judge was being careful about how this evidence was coming in. But more to the point, as Justice McKenna points out, was there, even the last incident, is there evidence that she actually left because of abuse or just that she left?
She just left. And that's how I read the record. But there is allegations of abuse. And it appeared from an exhaustive analysis of the record that it went both ways. And as there is in the record, there was some emotional abuse and things that Marlon's position that he confided in being sexually abused when he was younger. And when she would get angry at him, she would throw this in his face and tell him that he needed to get away from her and find somebody of the same gender that could meet his needs. And in fact, some of the testimony says that that happened the very night of the incident.
You know, one of the witnesses also said she dug out, but she always came back. Yeah,
yes.
They fight, they dig, she dig out, but come back. I think that might have been Aya. But, yeah.
So the question I would have is, let's go to the incident, the first of these incidents that came in involving the pickaxe. And my understanding of the proffer of the relevance is that not that she left, not that the complainant left or decedent left after that incident, but she had left days before, and that's what caused the incident to occur. So the pattern was not so much violence followed by her leaving. The pattern was her leaving to go be with her friends, then sometimes followed by violence, which the theory of the prosecution was that showed that this was something that had happened before, without the defendant snapping and shooting her. So if you could, again, and I understand those are slightly different theories, but as I understood that what the circuit court's analysis was, is that there had been prior, that the pattern, or at least a pattern, was she leaves to go be with her friends because they live in a remote valley. That causes him to become angry, and that leads sometimes to incidents, and that's what the trial court thought was relevant, and the probative value of that outweighed its prejudice. Could you react to that specifically with regard to the 2007 incident?
Your Honor, I cannot specifically remember the facts of that witness, which I believe was Nicole
IAS.
I don't recall that being related to her leaving him. But I do acknowledge there were incidents where she would leave, but there were also incidents where it was just alleged domestic abuse between the two of them.
Assuming that was that she had left, and that was the judge's theory, well then that would also exclude even the incident right before the one that caused her death, because if the theory is that she leaves and then there's abuse, then the abuse incident for the not only are none of the other ones of the same factual scenario, but even the one right before the death doesn't fit the 7-year-old one. So the judge, I think, did, as CJ mentioned, that did say that one time, but at least three other times he says, and one of them Justice Nakayama had just quoted too, if he's been inflicting abuse on Malia, whether it would be reasonable from his standpoint to then become upset or enraged by her departure. And then he says that at least three times, exactly the same situation. So it doesn't seem as if there's really a coherent underlying reasoning that was given.
I agree with you, Judge. I felt that it, in deference, and I have a lot of respect for this particular trial judge, but it was almost that it was a result-oriented decision, because we have Maliega to look at, which the government relied on. And the Maliega case, they say, and what's interesting is that they reversed in that case, but they said, we're going to address this issue of can intent, can evidence be provided for intent? And they said it can, because there was a motion in limine where the parties, the government, scrupulously argued and said why they need that evidence. And the trial judge decided that, yes, it's needed in that case because of the way Maliega was going to raise his defense. None of that was done in this case. Government agreed. They said, no, we agree with their motion in limine. Excuse me.
However, it did seem that the judge became particularly focused on this need to rebut the EMD defense as well as the penal responsibility defense when witness Alexis Holaniak was testifying. And you may recall when she was asked about her knowledge as to whether or not the victim had left in the past, the court changed its position on the motion in limine that you referred to and allowed for testimony on redirect in which the witness was talking about two incidents, one that involved a poker game, remember, where there was a threat involving the poker game, and then there was another incident in which there was a headbutting that occurred, I guess when the defendant went to pick up a daughter. But in any case, the judge allowed that reconsideration of the motion in limine based on the idea that it was necessary to rebut the idea that the actions of the defendant were a result of extreme emotional or mental distress or penal responsibility, and to show that instead there was a pattern of abuse. Abusive relationship was the real reason for the action that was taken by the defendant. It wasn't associated with the defenses that had to do with the state of mind or the mental health defenses. So how do you respond to that? How do you respond to the idea that at a certain point it was necessary for the government to provide proof that the abusive relationship was the reason for the actions of the defendant as opposed to a kind of mental health defense?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that Alex Holiniak, this testimony was also brought up on the case in chief. And at that point, part of our argument is that this bad acts evidence, if they come in at all, they come in as rebuttal. I mean, this was at the case in chief. I mean, so bad acts are coming in to impugn the defendant on his possible defenses, but he may have chosen not to put on any evidence at all. He may have decided they have not made their case. And one of our arguments is it in a manner forced him to put on evidence because the prosecution is being allowed to present things out of sequence. We did acknowledge
I'm not exactly following. Are you saying that there was a certain sequence when these two incidents would become relevant, for example, after the intent was proven, and at that point the defenses became relevant? Is that
depending
what
on what if the defendant put on evidence, then perhaps in rebuttal the prosecutor would have called witnesses, and then they would have rehashed over the bad acts, whether they're admissible or not. And I do stand before you acknowledging that I understand that there may be an issue here, even if it is error, that possibly the court says, well, evaluates, is this harmless error, because it would have come in on the defense side or the rebuttal side of the case.
So you're saying, but even though Mr. Dunn is saying, I may open the door, or I'm going to put in this evidence, and Mr. Higa says, you know, that might open the door. I'm going to say it opened the door, and Dunn says, it may very well. So even assuming that it did open the door, you're saying that even if it did open the door, the prosecution, while the witness is on the stand, can't go into evidence that was otherwise inadmissible?
That is a very good point, Judge. I would say that is correct. They cannot until the court does the proper analysis. And under Pinero,
well, that wasn't your argument just now. You just said that, no, they have to do it on rebuttal.
That's typically when it's done.
I understand that. But it's not a blanket rule. If there's if a door is open and the witness is on the stand, the state can redirect, can ask questions, can't it? If the door has been opened.
My office spent some time briefing this issue that the door doesn't it doesn't normally open in this kind of scenario, and there still needs to be that 403 analysis, which has six or seven steps.
And that assumes the door was even opened.
Yes, if the door is even open. So the safer thing for fairness to a defendant's right to a fair trial is let it come in on rebuttal, or have the government do the proper thing and file a motion to bring this up pretrial so that it can be briefed, argued, and decided and as to what can come in what manner, if they in fact do need that. Because otherwise, it's just like they're piling on the defendant. He's a domestic abuser. Look at this 8-year-old incident. And then when they get to the jury instruction and say, put this evidence on the issue of intent, The problem is the jury is, and we've submitted that that is incorrect. It should not have been focused on intent, because the court said you may only consider the bad acts as to whether the defendant had the intent to commit the crimes charged herein. And that's not what it should have said.
Well, perhaps the instruction was incorrect, but I'm still reaching to try to understand the order of proof that you're anticipating. Are you saying that during the government's case in chief, it can't produce evidence that addresses the issues of EMD as well as penal responsibility?
It can put on evidence, but if that evidence has to do with alleged prior bad acts of the defendant, it needs to go through a narrow analysis, which determines, is it overly prejudicial? What's the need for it? How much time has elapsed? Is there alternate proof? Will this make the jury hostile? Hearing that somebody murdered someone and they've had multiple allegations of domestic abuse over the previous 7 or 8 years, I would submit to this court is going to likely make them hostile towards the defendant and not to consider the defenses that he raises, 704 or EMED.
Okay, so sorry, EMED, I have a question.
Yes.
I think you're arguing that the prior bad acts should not have come in because they weren't relevant to and or elite, or they were prejudicial as to your EMED defense. And I understand your EMED defense to be that your client was under a extreme mental or emotional disturbance for which there was a reasonable explanation because she accused him of being gay or that he should go be with a man, right?
Yes.
And his defense, as you say, is that he's not an F and F, right? And so that's the defense. So I'm just wondering, in terms of EMED, I'm trying to figure out what the reasonable explanation, how we should construe that. So it is your argument that from the viewpoint of a reasonable person in the circumstances as the defendant believed them to be, it would be reasonable to have a extreme mental emotional disturbance by being accused of being gay.
There's the subjective-objective analysis, and I can't credibly argue before this court here that...
Yes, I'm trying to figure this out, because this is often, you know, like a defense used in, like, the trans defense. I didn't know that this was actually a transgendered person, so therefore it's very reasonable for me to have been under extreme emotional disturbance and to kill this person.
I think it was a combination of that and the fact that she was leaving him with the children and he was taking care of them and there was testimony.
Well, no, your application only refers to the gay issue. So I'm just trying to figure out what the reasonable standard is under these circumstances.
It would look at, there would be... I would say it's a question of fact for the jury to determine, but they would look at the context of subjectively what is facing this guy and how he reacted to it, and then objectively, and is that a way that a person would respond? But part of my argument on
but
the EMD,
they look at his from his perspective under his circumstances, which is psychiatric illness, which was pretty much undisputed, brain damage, which was pretty much undisputed, being called that, I mean, it's, the doctors said, you have to look at all of those things. It's
not four of the doctors said that he...
Is that really the test? I'm really trying to figure this out, because the statute says the reasonableness of the explanation shall be determined from the viewpoint of a reasonable person in the circumstances as the defendant believed them to be. So I'm trying to figure out whether we have to view this in the viewpoint of a reasonable person or...
I confess to this.
This defendant, as this defendant would reasonably believe.
I confess to this court that I anguished over the same language and what does it mean and how do I do this. And I spent yesterday reading Holborn, Russo, Kayama, Knight, Haile, Young. That is why I'm urging this court to consider the Haile decision to determine in our argument that jury instructions should define EMED in language. And even though prior cases have said, well, the legislature hasn't done it, the courts have seen fit to define what self-control is. And because self-control was allowed and objected to by defense counsel, EMED also should be defined, because while they are common words, and this court in Aviento even cited to that definition of where emotional state of an individual and they go through the steps is exposed to an extreme, unusual, overwhelming stress, and then C has extreme emotional reaction to it as a result of which there's a loss of control by reason is overborne by intense feelings such as passion, anger, distress, grief, excessive agitation. I don't think a jury gets there on just the four words, extreme mental or emotional distress.
To determine the reasonableness based on the facts, I get back to this question, if you could help me with this, Mr. Colm, about in determining reasonableness, why wouldn't the jury be able to look at prior incidents in which he had the problem of her leaving and he hadn't responded in the same way? After they'd had an argument, she left and he didn't respond the same way. Why wouldn't that be relevant to the idea of reasonableness for the EMED defense?
It may be reasonable to come in, but as we've said, we believe it shouldn't have come in the case in chief. And an improper 403 analysis was done, and the Panero factors were not applied to determining whether the evidence should have come in. But I have to agree that there would be a slightly different analysis and standard on the rebuttal side after the defendant had put on expert witnesses who did testify, two of them, Dr. Cohen and Dr. Atkins, that he was suffering from extreme emotional, mental and emotional stress.
Have you thought about which of these incidents might come in after the Panero analysis is applied? Which of these prior incidents?
Well, if I was trial counsel, I would fight to not have any of them come in, because based on the evidence that the government, I believe.
Is it because they're old or because the nature of the incidents were such that it's not sufficiently similar? I'm not, because if you have a situation in which they have this relationship that results in extreme anger and she leaves, and you concede that potentially could be relevant, why wouldn't any of these incidents be relevant to that, an example of how it didn't follow the same pattern?
I can see how that argument could be accepted by the trial court. And I also have to say, I said all of the incidents, but the one that was a week earlier, I think that probably comes in.
But don't you have to show the link? Don't you have to show that those prior abuse incidents led to a separation? That's the whole.
Yeah, I agree. Yes, you do. And not only that, if you're in federal court, you actually have to show some viability and proof that they actually did occur. Because it can't just be an allegation, somebody saying, well, this happened. And what's the corroboration?
Mr. Cohn, Justice Wilson's question was not about physical abuse, though. He asked specifically about evidence that she left. Not that it linked up or anything. So evidence that she left would have been, and that he didn't have the same reaction, is different from evidence of abuse, right?
Yes. Yes. And there was, as I know this court is aware, there's all kinds of other testimony, which is both interesting and colloquial in its sense of being in an outer island, that this is just the way local people are and this kind of relationship and the testimony.
If you'd like to reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal, please. Okay,
thank
that's
you.
Fine, and we'll hear from Mr. Higa at this point.
Aloha Kakahiaka. I'm Lynn Higa, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for the state. As to the Emed defense that he committed the murder while under the influence of an extreme mental or emotional disturbance, for which there's a reasonable explanation, and that reasonable explanation is from the standpoint of a reasonable person in those circumstances. I think this court has said previously that that's an objective standard. So the reasonableness is from the standpoint of a reasonable person, and this court has also said in prior cases, and please don't ask me which ones, but that a reasonable person is not crazy. A reasonable person doesn't have a mental illness. A reasonable person doesn't have abandonment issues.
Doesn't right? have a, I didn't hear that last word. Doesn't have a...
Abandonment issues, because that's what the defense was hitting pretty hard in its opening and throughout the trial. If you recall, in Mr. Dunn's opening statement, he all but conceded the murder. I mean, if you remember at the end, he said, then he did something completely insane. He killed his girlfriend.
Killing is different than murder.
Yeah, that's true. But so he's not disputing the killing.
How should we handle a situation, putting aside this case, that we have said that prior bad acts can be relevant to an EMED defense? In another case, at least one other case, we've said so. So what if we were to layer on the additional penal responsibility defense? It seems to me that the penal responsibility defense is the primary defense because it's basically an acquittal, whereas the defense of EMED is a mitigating defense that merely reduces the murder to a manslaughter.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, in a situation in which you do have prior bad acts that may be relevant to EMED but not relevant to penal responsibility, should there be a bifurcation? Try the penal responsibility defense first, and if the jury comes back without that, then get into the facts of the EMED for the mitigating defense?
Well, first, just to clarify, I think the NGI is not like a regular acquittal. I mean, he could very well spend the rest of his life
right.
at HSH,
right.
so that could be worse than
but there are people that have gotten out, that have recovered after a killing
right.
and have
right.
been released into
right.
the community.
Yeah.
Right?
Was that one of the theories in this case?
I'm not saying it applies. This clearly does not apply in this case. I'm just wondering how
I'd never
we would
considered
deal with
that. I'm sorry. That's a... I never considered the bifurcation.
So could you address what, you know, the theories that the circuit court appeared to have in allowing this evidence in this case in chief? Again, going back to the 2007 incident, and then I think there was a 2012 incident in front, and again, trying to be sure I keep the rebuttal versus the case in chief straight, but 2007 incident involving the pickaxe, and then an incident, I believe it was in 2012, involving choking out in front of the apartment. So what were the trial court's theories as to why that evidence comes in?
Again, it was because of opening the door. The motions in limine, the state did agree with the defendant's motion in limine precluding bad acts evidence. We also brought a motion in limine to preclude bad acts evidence. Both were granted. Now, in the discussion in the hearing on the motions in limine, every time I said I had no objection to the preclusion of bad act evidence, the preclusion of prior criminal behavior, the preclusion of prior record, I gave the caveat, unless the door is open. I agree that with the order in limine precluding this, unless the door is open.
Well, I get your theme about you think that this evidence was admissible because the door was open. So let's talk about what it means to open the door. And if you could help me, Mr. Higa, with this moment in the trial again that was interesting to me, where Alexis Heleniak testifies, and then after the cross-examination, the judge says, okay, now she can testify to certain incidents that were excluded during the motion in limine, these two incidents that involved headbutting and another involving a threat around a poker game. And the reason the judge gave, and correct me if you think the record reads otherwise, but was to show that there's a pattern of an abusive relationship here. This is a domestic violence case with an abusive relationship. It's not a case that involves a defense based on mental disease or emotional distress or mental distress. So the judge seemed to let these prior bad acts in to show there's an alternative reason for the defendant acting the way that he did that's inconsistent with the EMED defense and the penal responsibility defense. Would you agree that the judge said
that it was an alternative, he allowed it as an alternative explanation?
So if that's the case, do you open the door when you assert an EMED defense or penal responsibility? Then can all means of domestic violence that's been between the victim and the defendant in the past become admissible?
No, not as a general rule. In this particular case, I mean, in the other cases that have been mentioned here, I think it was like Pinero and Castro, I mean, the prosecution wanted to bring in prior bad acts evidence in the case in chief from the very beginning. They filed a notice of 404B.
Yes, and those were cases in which you have a defendant that's saying, I wasn't engaging in domestic abuse, I haven't used violence in the past, and then the court said, well, you, in that case, we're going to, in a sense, allow these prior bad acts to impeach your credibility.
Right, but this case is different in that. That was not done in this case. We did not want to present prior bad acts evidence as our evidence in chief. Okay, so, but there was lots of discussion beforehand.
Well, how does this help me? How does this open the door at this point where you've got the witness that's asked a question about, do you know that the defendant separated and left after these prior domestic violence incidents, and then the judge says, okay, the door's been opened, so now you can show prior abusive relationship.
Yeah, but I think it's more like this. For example, if just as an example, as a hypothetical, defense on cross-examination asks the witness, isn't it true that the complainant and the defendant got into an argument on such and such a day? Yes, it's true. Okay, fine. On rebuttal, on redirect, am I not entitled to ask them, what were you arguing about?
Yes,
because the door has been opened. The issue has been opened.
To that point, when you're talking to Ms. Aiea is asked, and she does at the first instance talk about arguments that they had gotten into, and you said since the defense is asked on cross about arguments in the past they have had, the state would submit the door has been open for us to ask the nature of those arguments. At least some of the arguments involved a prior abuse and Malia leaving to get away from the defendant.
Right.
Was there evidence of Malia leaving to get away from the defendant?
Justice McKenna asked about whether there was evidence of direct evidence of abuse happening and then there being a separation. I have to confess, I didn't look at the record, review the record to look for those things, except for the last one.
Which was the only one he didn't object to.
The last abuse in the car?
The abuse that, the one that happened 4 days before.
Yeah.
That one was not objected to.
Okay. But that's one in which, and I think there was, on Saturday she left to help her friends prepare for a party. He looked for her, found her, beat her in the car. She never went back home after that. He then was looking for her on Tuesday when the shooting occurred. So at least as to that incident, there was an abuse. She didn't go home. He looked for her. The difference in that one is that defense witness Marietta Alapai testified that he showed up at her house at about 6 p.m. I think he shot her about 9.
But we're concerned about, or I shouldn't say we're concerned, but the question is about all the other incidents. Justice Nakayama just read a representation that you made, and I think it was persuasive, or somehow the judge believed that these prior incidents, that there was this scenario similar to this case, and that wasn't borne out by the priors that were admitted. And that's aside from the problem that some of them are 6 years old.
Okay, it is in rebuttal to, if he's saying that there were arguments that he was, and for Nicole Ayer, I never opened that up in direct, right? That only came up in cross. I never opened anything up in direct. Before, in the course of cross, that's when Mr. Dunn said, I want to get into these arguments that they had. Again, towards his theory of abandonment, that he was a good father trying to keep his family together, and she was this wild young woman that was going off and just, you know, gallivanting about. And he's the beleaguered father. If he's going to raise those issues on cross-examination of Nicole Ayer, I should be able to ask Nicole Ayer about what was the nature of those arguments, bring out the fact that there had been a violent...
So, in other words, question about these two folks had arguments, sometimes they would separate. Once there's that question, that allowed all the priors to come in, because that does seem to be what was the rationale of the government introducing and the court's reasoning. The court seems to just...
No, I wouldn't characterize it as basically letting the floodgates open. I asked for a lot more evidence to be introduced than I was allowed to put in. I mean, Judge Cardozo did go through an analysis as far as the temporal relationship, the nature of the evidence that I was putting in, and how it would relate to the defense of Emet.
You know, you argued that these priors could come in. At one point, you wanted to get these priors in substantively because you had said, well, you know, we touched on them when we were cross-examining one of the doctors, but now you wanted to get them in substantively to refute the EMED defense. Excuse me, to the penal irresponsibility defense. So your argument was that you could get the priors in through lay witnesses to refute a mental defense. That's what you... I can read it to you. Was that correct?
I don't know. I don't recall if... Okay, if that's what I said, that's wrong. Because even though Judge allowed that the explicitly, when he was ruling on each of the priors that he would allow in, he said that it was relevant to the EMED, and then he would add that it could also be relevant to the 704 defense. In my opinion, it's relevant to the EMED defense, not to the 704.
So why was a 2007 incident involving the pickaxe? Could you please articulate the theory of relevance?
It's as to the nature of the relationship that he was controlling, that he was violent in trying to maintain control over Malia. And that was, you know, one of the alternative themes of him saying, I'm an abandoned husband. No.
But why wouldn't that allow all prior incidents, not just the pickaxe incident that CJ was talking about, but any prior incidents under that theory?
What,
you would agree that there's a limit in terms of relevancy that pertains to time? That...
Well, no, that's why I offered so much more. But I think for Judge Cardoza, I think he wanted it limited as far as time and also as to the nature. How strong is it? Because, you know, on
well,
each of them.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you mentioned the strong. So I wanted to ask you about harmless error, because let's assume that the prior incidents were admitted in error, except maybe for the one that just preceded the killing. In the answering brief of the government, it doesn't seem to address harmless error. So would you concede that if those prior bad acts that were admitted in error, that it would not be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Taking it step by step, first the murder, then the 704, then the EMED. As to the murder, there is overwhelming evidence of the murder, right? He committed it in front of two eyewitnesses. Well, a third.
I'm not sure that's a defense, though. I mean, the defense isn't that he, as you said, you know, obviously he committed an act that took the life of the victim. But the issue here has to do with, you might say, as defenses go, a fairly involved one, right? The EMED defense as well as a penal responsibility. So sort of a battle of experts to a certain extent. Right? And this is evidence that pertains to the opinions of the experts, and the experts were in conflict, so.
Right, but to the question about overwhelming evidence of guilt, harmlessness. On the 704, now looking at that, yeah, they had three doctors that they called. We had two of the three panel that we called. But if you look at them, Dr. Cole didn't know the difference between a 704 defense and an EMED defense. Dr. Combe, when I gave him pictures and other evidence that were material to the facts of the case, he didn't know what they were. He wasn't familiar with the facts of the case enough to identify even the primary players.
Isn't there you acknowledged, I think, in your closing that Dr. Acklin was the most knowledgeable, okay, and had the most basic or the most wide-ranging factual base, and one of your doctors hadn't even looked at some of the...
That was their doctor.
No.
Dr. Blinder. What? Dr. Blinder was their doctor.
No, I'm saying I think it was... I can go back and pull it up, but I think it was... Did Cunningham testify?
Oh, Cunningham... Yeah, Cunningham misapprehended one of the... something in the record. There was like 700 pages of medical record.
His past record. So, right. Rather... I'd like to go back to one thing you just said. You acknowledged that the priors couldn't come in substantively, if I understood you right, to refute the penal responsibility defense.
This is my confusion, is that there was no limiting instruction on the priors.
Exactly.
They all came in substantively.
So the court, in fact, instructed that they could use all of the priors for intent.
For intent. So it's limited to that, but
But the court and you, during closing, you actually argued as well that they could use the priors. And I think what the court utilized the word intent more broadly to mean mental condition, because that's how the court utilized that term, and that's in fact the way you argued it too. You said that the prior incidents of abuse were relevant to rebut both defenses. And in fact, that's what the court, in essence, instructed by equating intent with emotional disturbance and penal responsibility, making it mental condition. So in a sense, the jury was told that they could do something which I don't think the law permitted under the facts of this case.
That the law would not permit the use of the prior abuses to on any of the issues on 704 or EMED?
Under the way that they were admitted, they could certainly have been used if the doctors had testified, look, these prior incidents, either your doctor said, look, these prior incidents show that they were, that this wasn't penal responsibility, or during cross-examination, the doctors had been crossed and saying, look, refuting what you say, didn't he commit these abuses? And then the court would have let them in for the limited purpose to evaluate the doctor's opinions. But they weren't instructed that way, and the evidence didn't come out in that manner.
Okay. I'm sorry to be a little thick on this, but I'm sure that I'm missing your point.
Mr. Hegel, was it your position at trial that his prior actions were inconsistent with his defense? Is that the argument you were trying to raise? That he lacked response? Well, certainly for EMED, he's claiming that he was he reacted, you know, in the way he did because of her leaving. And your theory was, well, she had actually these kinds of things that happened often before. And I'm not trying to, I'm just asking what your theory was.
Right. For Emed, you don't even need expert witnesses. I mean, Emed is the type of defense that I would maintain you don't even need expert witnesses. Now, the state's, let me first go through the defense, and then I'll tell you the state's theory. But the defense's theory was that he was under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance at the time of the killing, for which there's a reasonable explanation. What is the reasonable explanation? He was being abandoned. He had been abandoned multiple times. His father testified on defense that Malia had left him 7 or 8 times in the course of their relationship. And each time, he would have to take care of the kids. He'd have to walk them down this long path out of the valley and back up home and all of these other things. Okay, and that's the reasonable explanation, that from the standpoint of a reasonable person, a father being abandoned by his wife and the mother of his children would... That's a reasonable explanation for the extreme mental or emotional disturbance that he was under the influence of at the time of the killing. The state's theory was, in rebuttal to that, was that he was not under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance because there is much evidence about self-control from the way he handled the gun, from the fact that he shot only Malia and no one else, the fact that he shot her through the chest, etc. Now, as to the second part, reasonableness of the explanation. The reasonableness of the explanation, our answer to that was no, he was not an abandoned father. He was an abusive father, and that's why Malia was left him 7 or 8 times.
Was there evidence of that?
Pardon?
Was there evidence of that?
His father testified that she left 7 or 8 times.
No, but I mean evidence that that's why she left.
Only circumstantially.
Wasn't there more evidence that she left because, you know, I mean, they lived in a valley. There's no phone service even.
There's no internet. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question now regarding a reasonable person for EMED. So reasonable person for EMED, it's a gendered analysis. In other words, it's a reasonable man versus a reasonable woman because... Like, if it's a reasonable man would have EMED because his wife leaves with the wife leaves and he has to take care of the children, would that also apply to a woman every time a husband leaves and the wife has to take care of the children? It becomes a mitigating defense?
That's an interesting... You know, I think the statute says reasonable person.
Right. So is it a non-gendered analysis?
I think legally it's stated non-gendered, but I can conceive of situations where an attorney might argue to a jury to use their common sense and common life experience about the differences in society still between men and women and the responsibilities in the home.
Is the law to recognize gendered differences and defenses? You know, would it be reasonable for a woman to kill someone because she's accused of being gay? Or would it be reasonable for a woman to kill someone to get a mitigating defense because the husband left for a while and made her take care of the children?
Okay. So in other words, if an attorney, to put it another way,
right,
just to make sure
I'm trying to figure out what the defense is. Is it a man versus woman, or is it a reasonable person? How do we analyze what a reasonable person is?
Well, answering the general question first, I think since the statute says explicitly reasonable person, it's non-gendered, then that morphs into the question that if an attorney then argues, like makes a sexist argument, saying, well, this was an attack on his manhood, this was, you know, that kind of thing, then to me, anyway, what raises in my, then is that an illegal argument? I mean, we do have, I believe, ethical rules saying that we are not to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or sex
or gender
or any of that kind of thing. So would it be an illegal argument for an attorney to appeal to those biases? Because that's what it would be, right? An attorney would be appealing to the discriminatory stereotypes of a jury, to say, oh, my client, because he's a man, has a special status under the EMED defense. I guess that would be an illegal argument.
I'm sorry, go ahead, CJ.
Mr. Higa, could you explain the testimony or the relevance and the 403 analysis with regard to the testimony of Alexis Holiniak? This is the 2012
strangulation
incident. How does that fit into any theory other than this is an individual who's abusive, other than he's possibly being inferred as being a bad person because he strangled her?
And she didn't leave.
Yeah, well, I don't believe that there was any evidence presented that she left as a result of that incident or that she, in fact, left after that incident.
Not much except the observation that this thing happened out right. The parking lot of the building, I think. Right?
No, it was downstairs. I think Alexis saw it through the slats of
okay.
the floor.
So how does that fit into a theory that this is relevant to something other than that the defendant was a bad person?
Again, it goes to rebut his general characterization of himself as an abandoned father. No, he's not an abandoned father. He's an abusive.
But do we know anything leading about what led up to that incident? And I apologize if that, other than that this incident happened. So,
no, just that the incident, I think there was, the only context we have from Alexis is that they were, Malia and Marlon were visiting the people that lived downstairs from her, that she, before the strangulation, she heard argument, raised voices. She heard Marlon's voice. She heard Malia's voice yelling. And then when she looked down, she saw them come out to the landing, and that's why she could see them. And he saw Marlon put his hands on her throat, and Malia was turning pink. And then her husband went downstairs, told him to come.
Now, how does that... other than just being the fact that he is somebody who strangles his partner, how's that, what's the relevance, what does that show about their relationship or the nature of his, how does that even go to abandonment? Because that's the theory that you say you're rebutting. How does that rebut abandonment?
Yeah, it goes to the issue of the reasonableness of the explanation for his being under the influence of an extreme mental or emotional disturbance. So it goes to that second part, second element, the reasonableness. Because he's saying it's reasonable for him to have been under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance because he's, you know, because she keeps stepping out on him. Okay, so in rebuttal to that, no, that's not reasonable because what's happening is, in fact, she's not, that you are being abusive to her. And so that's why she's stepping on it.
Although we don't have the context in this incident.
We don't have the context except that they were verbally arguing like seconds beforehand.
But we don't even really know what about or...
No.
So doesn't that equate to just any prior incident of abuse could come in under that theory? I mean, with limits as to time and, you know, quality of the evidence. But why... that's just a theory that, you know, he abuses her, so he's not, you know, he's a person in power and control. He's not abandoned. But, again, it's not tied into your theory. That's my question to you. It doesn't appear to be directly tied in other than the fact that it tends to show that he's somebody who asserts himself through physical violence, even though we don't know what the context was. So I'm just asking you if you can clarify that for me.
But yeah, it is... maybe I'm not understanding you as well, but it is...
Does any prior act of physical abuse come in under your theory? Because it shows that he is somebody who's in charge, in control. He's not somebody who's abandoned and...
Where it would show that he is not, as he alleges, an abandoned father, and that that's why he acted the way he did. Insofar as it rebuts his theory of abandonment and is relevant to the second element of EMED, which is reasonableness.
Right, so if the fight was about, hey, I'm leaving you, and then he did this, that might be one thing, but apparently we don't even know what the fight is about. It's just that he choked her. So where's the tie-in to your theory?
Well, since he is presenting evidence that she did, in fact, leave him on several occasions, just as Judge Cardoza said in his explanation of why he was letting it in, is that that goes to the reasonableness of him being upset that she is leaving him when he is the one that's driving her away. It's one thing to just simply be abandoned by this woman. It's another thing to be driving the woman away.
But there's no evidence that she was driven away at that point in time.
But isn't it to say that, okay, you got beaten on
But the judge used it to even let in a 6 or 7 year old prior incident. In other words, there was no limits.
Well, the Judge Cardoza explicitly said that he was considering temporal limits. I mean, that is something. I know the defense says that he made no analysis, no 403 analysis. But while, you know, we may disagree, he did go through the analysis. The record does show each time that he considered this, he explicitly said he was considering the temporal.
He did seem to be, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but he did seem to be focused on the temporal analysis. But Mr. Higa, let's say that the temporal analysis applies in the sense that there are a series of incidents that are relatively close to the incident that's at issue. And you have a domestic violence case, as you know, very common case, and you have a defendant that's alleging that the defendant acted out of self-defense when he used, for example, the force that he did, or he acted in a way that was meant to protect somebody else. But in any case, he asserts a defense that is contrary to the idea that he was acting through a pattern of abuse, acting through a pattern that's a traditional pattern where you have the male in a position of power and abusing that power. And so the prosecution says, our need now is to rebut that he was acting in self-defense, or he's acting to protect somebody else, and to show that he was acting in a conformance with a pattern of abuse. Why wouldn't your analysis suggest that, therefore, any temporal incident that involves abuse would be admissible? Any prior bad act that's temporally qualifies would be admissible.
Yeah, I'm not saying that any prior bad acts of abuse in an abusive, in a DD case, would be admissible to rebut any defense. I'm trying to imagine how it would be used to rebut a self-defense. I'm having a little difficulty with that. But
the idea would be he wasn't actually acting to protect himself, because look, all these other times when he was acting, he didn't seem to be feeling like he was in danger. He used violence because it worked, so he didn't have to worry about being in danger.
Yeah, well, no, I am not supporting a proposition that in a DV case, 404B evidence is admissible to rebut any defense. That is not the position I'm taking.
Mr. Higa,
did you? I'm sorry.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify, because you said the judge made it was temporal, and he made time and went through the Pinero analysis. When Maikui was first called, you attempted to question him in the state's case. The court was concerned about the time frame that what Maikui was going to testify, and so did not allow you to do it at that time. And then you recalled him during rebuttal, and during rebuttal, the defense objected that the incident was extremely remote in time in relation to the shooting, prejudicial, not probative. The court overruled the objection without the state even responding, and this was the reasoning. All right, I'll allow the testimony. It was during the defense case, a significant amount of testimony concerning the EMED. Anyway, I'll allow it.
Sorry, which witness?
That was the court's ruling about Maikui. No explanation about just allowing it and not even actually allowing it without even the state responding.
Okay, this is...
this was the one 6 years...
On Saturday.
This was the one that occurred. It happened, the transcript is from June 10th. It was Maikui testifying 6 years before the shooting that she saw Lavoie punch her in the arm.
Oh, when they passed her on the side of the road.
And that's the entirety of the ruling. Anyhow, I just want to offer, I'm not asking a question, I just wanted to clarify.
Did the state ever argue in this case that the prior, that this was actually a power and control dynamic?
You know, I think I suggested it in opening, but I never went back to it.
You never it wasn't in closing, right?
No, because we just...
Why did the ICA rely on Mylenga in ruling that the prior bad acts came in for EMED when the state didn't even argue power and control?
Well, I mean, we didn't have a situation like Clark where it's, like that stark of a DV case and a recantation, you know, that sort of thing. This was...
Mylenga was not a recantation either, right? Wasn't she dead?
Yeah. She was dead, so she couldn't respond.
But the prior bad acts came in for power and control, right?
Right. Well,
you didn't argue that in this case.
That was not a strong point. As the evidence developed, I saw it more... I saw the evidence being more strongly towards the issue of control, that I had more evidence to show that he was in control of what he was doing, and, you know, therefore it wasn't necessary to go to some kind of theory that would be more abstruse to a lay jury.
Mr. Higa, anything to wrap up at this time?
No, I'm sorry. I feel like I've left a lot of questions half-answered. I'm sorry.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Combe, your rebuttal.
Thank you. May I ask how much time I have? Thank you. Very quickly, there were some questions that Chief Justice asked and that Judge Wilson followed up on with regards to the, I think it was a 2012 incident. And I heard the government say that it was evidence that could be used towards the abandonment theory and that it goes to reasonableness. I would point out that they were still on their case in chief. There was no testimony about abandonment because that came in on the defendant's case. And also that reasonableness as an issue is a concept that's in the affirmative defense of EMED. And that case law, Hawaii case law in Holburn and in Anderson at 58 Hawaii 179 say that an affirmative defense is not an element of an offense that must be negated by the prosecutor. So they had no need to put evidence in. It was putting the cart before the horse. And that is the issue we've tried to hit on this appeal and to argue before this court. And
As I did with Mr. Higa, if you have any final thoughts or a wrap-up at this point, Mr. Combe?
I would like to thank the court for this time, and we urge you to find for my client and his arguments. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.